Now, Elizabeth's Women by Tracy Borman, a biography of Elizabeth I told through the women who influenced her life. For almost 30 years, Mary, Queen of Scots, was ruthless in her desire to reclaim her Scottish throne and a promise of the English succession. Following the Ridolfi plot in 1572, one of her most serious attempts to usurp Elizabeth, she was effectively under house arrest in the custody of the Earl of Shrewsbury. Emma Fielding reads the fourth extract from Elizabeth's Women.
While rumours and plots continued to surround Mary Stuart after the Ridolfi plot in 1572, the years that followed were comparatively quiet, and she seemed more resigned to her captivity. Although her movements were now subjected to closer scrutiny than before, she still lived a comfortable life and was served as a queen. But the traumas of her former life in Scotland, together with the strain of her ongoing captivity in England, were beginning to take their toll on Mary. She railed against the English Queen and her regime. This occasioned some alarm among Elizabeth's ministers, who were anxious lest Mary should involve herself in another plot against their mistress. By 1584, Elizabeth herself was said to be utterly distrustful of this bosom serpent. In January 1585, Mary was removed from the custody of the Earl of Shrewsbury on the grounds that he had become too sympathetic to his captive. Under the guardianship of Sir Amias Paulet, her imprisonment became more onerous. This fresh misery prompted her to undertake a course of action so dangerous that if it failed, she would lose everything, her life included. In the summer of 1586, Anthony Babington, a Catholic gentleman, masterminded a plot to assassinate Elizabeth and place Mary on the throne. Elizabeth's spymaster, Sir Francis Walsingham, soon heard of it and determined to lay a trap for the Scottish Queen. A channel of communication was established whereby Mary would send coded letters hidden in beer barrels to the conspirators. Little did she know that these were intercepted by Walsingham. All she had to do was mention Elizabeth's death, and it would be treason. He did not have to wait long. On the 17th of July, Mary wrote to Babington endorsing his suggestion that the English Queen be dispatched by a group of noblemen. "Set the six gentlemen to work," she urged. Under torture, Babington and his fellow conspirators confessed to the whole plot and, crucially, Mary's complicity in it. Yet however great Elizabeth's anger, and however much she might rant to her courtiers and ministers about her cousin's treachery, she still shrank from deciding her fate. Only after intense pressure did Elizabeth agree to appoint a commission for Mary's trial. Although Mary defended herself with skill and dignity, the verdict was never in question. On the 25th of October, Mary, Queen of Scots, was found guilty of conspiring towards the hurt, death and destruction of the royal person of our sovereign lady, the Queen. On the 4th of December, it was proclaimed that Mary should be put to death. Yet no execution could go ahead unless Elizabeth signed the warrant herself. And still she wavered. This was partly because of a justifiable concern that putting Mary to death would threaten England's international security, for France or Spain might well launch a revenge attack. But there was another more pressing concern that above all else made Elizabeth flinch from signing the warrant. Mary was an anointed queen. She was also of Tudor blood. Elizabeth lamented, "What will they now say that for the safety of her life, a maiden queen could be content to spill the blood even of her own kinswoman?" Perhaps the agony of her decision was intensified still further by the horror she still felt over her own mother's execution. This was undoubtedly the greatest crisis of her reign so far, and she almost broke down under the stress. In November, while Elizabeth was seeking refuge at her favourite palace of Richmond, a parliamentary delegation arrived to put yet more pressure on her to conform to their wishes. Her response illustrated how tormented she was by the dilemma she faced. "I assure you," she told the astonished members, if the case stood between her and myself only. If it had pleased God to have made us both milkmaids with pails on our arms, so that the matter should have rested between us two. And that I knew she did and would seek my destruction still. Yet could I not consent to her death. Dismissing her statesman, she told them, I must desire you to hold yourself satisfied with this answer answerless. Elizabeth had made it clear that if Mary were to repent, then she would spare her life. Her cousin stubbornly refused to oblige. Elizabeth knew it was now a choice between Mary's life and her own. By the end of January, Elizabeth had apparently decided that death was the only option for Mary. Still shrinking from sanctioning her execution, she urged Paulet to ease her of this burden by secretly putting Mary to death with poison or some other means. This would absolve Elizabeth of responsibility and also clear her of blame in the eyes of the world. Paulet utterly refused. With no other option left to her, on the 1st of February, Elizabeth signed her cousin's death warrant. The controversy surrounding this action has been the subject of intense debate ever since. The central question is whether Elizabeth, as she later claimed, signed the warrant but ordered her secretary, William Davison, not to issue it until she gave the order. However, in Davison's own account, made during his incarceration in the Tower, he said that Elizabeth had signed the warrant, apparently without a care. She had told him to inform Walsingham that she had at last given in to him and others and ordered Mary's execution, joking that the grief thereof would go near, as she merrily said, to kill him. The apparently blasé way in which the Queen had signed the warrant made Davison confident that she was not about to change her mind. On the morning of the 8th of February, 1587, Mary, Queen of Scots, mounted the scaffold. She was barely recognisable from the beautiful woman who had so beguiled the world. An eyewitness described her as round-shouldered, a face fat and broad, double-chinned and hazel-eyed, borrowed hair. She was ever one for theatrical gestures. When her ladies took off her outer gown, it revealed an underdress of scarlet, the colour of martyrs. When Mary lowered her head onto the block and gave the signal that she was ready for death, the executioner struck at her neck with his axe, but missed, and instead sliced into the side of her face. It was only with the third blow that Mary's head finally fell. Mary's desire to set herself up as a martyr had succeeded. As news of her execution spread across Europe, she was portrayed as a brave Catholic princess who had died at the hands of that wicked heretic, the Queen of England. Upon being told that her cousin had been executed, Elizabeth was apparently at first not able to comprehend it. Her words failed her, claimed William Camden, the 17th century chronicler. She was, in a manner, astonished. The next morning, she screamed out against the execution as a thing she never commanded or intended. In near hysterical fury, she threatened to throw all her councillors in the Tower for such blatant defiance of her orders, and also affected a show of extreme sorrow at the death of her cousin. An ambassador at court concurred that she had taken to her bed owing to the great grief she suffered through this untoward event. Elizabeth's great grief was viewed with some scepticism by her enemies abroad. Philip II declared, "It is very fine for the Queen of England now to give out that it was done without her wish, the contrary being so clearly the case." Indeed, her show of anguish may have been largely for the benefit of such potentates. One of the reasons she had held back from ordering the execution was because she feared an international backlash. Worse was expected from James VI, for quite apart from the political implications, it was his own mother who had been executed. Elizabeth wrote an impassioned letter to him, full of grief at Mary's execution and putting the blame squarely upon others. James was easily appeased. It was reported that if the Queen persisted in declaring her innocence, the King shall love her and honour her before all other princes. He went on to publicly excuse her of all blame in the late execution of his mother, and layeth the same upon her counsel. At least some of the fury Elizabeth directed against her counsellors may have been inspired by resentment at the fact that for the first time in her reign, they had forced her into making a decision. Until then, she had always succeeded in procrastinating long enough for the issue at hand to be resolved or superseded by another more pressing concern. It was the first occasion upon which she, a female sovereign, had allowed herself to be bullied by her male counsellors. She resolved that it would never happen again. What appalled Elizabeth most, however, was that she had put a fellow sovereign to death. She had an almost superstitious revulsion about doing so, convinced that vengeance would be wreaked upon her by either an earthly or heavenly force. Fear for her own future now mingled with remorse, for Mary had called upon the Catholic powers to avenge her death. And the very next year, the greatest of them took her at her word. In May 1588, Philip II launched his armada against England, ostensibly in Mary's name. Elizabeth was forced to lead her country into battle. When the English Queen emerged victorious, it transformed her image into one of invincible majesty. In finally resolving the complex question of what to do with Mary, Queen of Scots, and in dealing with the dramatic repercussions that followed, Elizabeth was able to mature into the Gloriana of legend. She made sure her subjects were in little doubt that the victory was thanks to God's favour towards her, and ordered commemorative medals to be struck that carried the words, "God blew with his wind, and they were scattered." Emphasising her divine status, Elizabeth claimed that it was because she had been chosen by God that she, a mere woman, was able to rise above her natural weaknesses and rule over a kingdom. By presenting herself as God's chosen queen, Elizabeth ensured that no subject, whether male or female, could oppose her will. As her reign progressed, Elizabeth became not just God's representative on earth, but a divinity herself, the peerless virgin queen, whose powers set her apart from ordinary mortals. Presenting herself in this way was a stroke of genius, for it rendered her maidenly state something to be celebrated and admired. And in rallying her troops at Tilbury, when the armada was imminent, she had given one of the most famous speeches of her reign, telling the assembled masses, "I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and a king of England too." And in her golden speech of 1601, Elizabeth claimed the glorious name of a king, but added that she had the royal authority of a queen. This interchanging of imagery was what made her such a brilliant monarch. It set her apart from all her predecessors, kings and queens alike, and created a unique identity that would assume iconic status both during her own lifetime and over the centuries that followed.
And tomorrow, Emma Fielding reads the final extract from Elizabeth's Women by Tracy Borman. It's been abridged by Katie Nicol, and the producer was Elizabeth Allard.